wildlife is being destroyed by overgrazing domesticated livestock. Gobi bears travel great distances from oasis to oasis, and because humans, including poachers and illegal miners, depend on the same oasis water supplies, the outcome for the bears is often tragic. In 2014, the Gobi's numbers fell to under 30 and have since risen. There is hope. They need more love. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World Radio production.
And you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI. WBAI.org on the web. It's 9 a.m. on a Thursday morning. Coming up next, Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize for another world as possible, and we are the ones to make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Later on, the inside story of our age of plutocratic plunder and stashed cash. The wealth hoarders, how billionaires pay millions to hide trillions. But first, we speak with Pauline Park, a transgender activist, writer, co-founder of Queens Pride House, a center for the LGBTQIA communities of Queens, and I've been Queer Koreans of New York, and co-founder of the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy Niagara, the first statewide transgender advocacy organization in New York. And we'll talk about the centuries-long history of anti-Asian racism and violence in the U.S. and the Atlanta murders. Well, if that wasn't a hate crime, what is? Pauline Park, isn't it fundamental that the public understand that the March 16th Atlanta massacre of 8 people and murder of 6 Asian American Pacific Islander women be understood to be a hate crime directed at women who are not incidentally, but are specifically of Asian Pacific Islander ancestry?
It certainly is, and the Atlanta massacre was certainly one of the most shocking hate crimes against women of Asian descent in recent American history. However, what makes it unusual is not the violence, but rather the fact that it is the first such hate crime against Asian Americans that has been reported in the mainstream U.S. news media consistently for an extended period of time. To understand it fully, we have to understand it within the context of the long history of racism, discrimination, and violence against people of Asian and Pacific Islander descent here in the United States, which goes back to the very first immigrants from Asia. Chinese immigrants came to California in the 1850s. Most Americans are aware of the fact that there's been a long history of racialized violence against African Americans that goes back to the origins of the slave trade when Africans brought over in chains and slave ships from Africa. However, most Americans are probably not aware of the fact that 19 Chinese immigrants were murdered by a lynch mob in Los Angeles in Chinatown in 1871, including two women and one child. The history of anti-Asian violence in the United States is inextricably entwined with the history of anti-immigration legislation. I imagine most Americans now think of anti-immigration legislation as being directed against immigrants from Latin America. However, historically, the origins of anti-immigration legislation in the United States really trace to anti-Asian animus directed primarily against Chinese immigrants. So, in fact, the very first law enacted by Congress to restrict immigration from any country was the 1875 Page Act, which effectively banned Chinese women on the invidious assumption that all Chinese women immigrants were engaged in sex work. This was, in fact, an abrogation of the Burlingame Treaty of 1868, which established free trade between China and the United States, and which was subsequently amended by the Angel Treaty of 1880, and by the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which itself was subsequently expanded and made permanent by the Geary Act in 1892, which effectively banned all immigration from China and Asia. That law was only lightly amended by the Magnuson Act of 1943, which allowed exactly 105 Chinese immigrants to enter per year, and that only as a token gesture to the Republic of China, which was an ally of the United States in World War II against Japan. There was a subsequent Immigration and Nationality Act enacted by Congress in 1952, which fully codified national quotas, which was really steeped in white supremacist notions, giving immigrants from Great Britain by far the largest national quota, smaller quotas for immigrants from Italy and southern European countries, and minuscule quotas for immigrants from the rest of the world, including Asia. It wasn't until 1965, when Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Immigration and Nationality Act into law, that the national origins formula was finally abolished, and immigration from Asia rose, bringing the total percentage of Asian Americans from less than 1% up to 3%. Asian Americans are now actually the fastest growing immigrant group in the United States, but this only dates from 1965.
In terms of the different things that you've mentioned about the immigration periods which you've been tracing, is it fair to say that the entire nature of immigration when it relates to the Asian populations and countries, and there are dozens of countries, there are at least 48 that make up Asia, have been defined by imperialist design over issues of resources and the need for labor, etc., but they were always cloaked in a white nationalist sensitivity and evolved out of Eurocentric supremacy as well. Would you characterize it that way?
That's certainly true. There are two or three elements there that we have to untangle. One is the need for cheap labor. And in fact, as many people know, Chinese immigrants built the railways east from San Francisco, whereas Irish immigrants built the railways to the west, coming from the east. Even though, important note, Chinese immigrants were excluded from the photo of the Golden Spike that finally completed the Transcontinental Railway. Now, the other element is U.S. involvement with Asia, which really began in earnest with U.S. participation in the carving up of China with the unequal treaty system in the 19th century, the U.S. joining European powers in Japan in carving up China and subjecting it to a neoliberal, a neo-colonial status. Now, U.S. involvement in Asia began in earnest in 1898, when the U.S. defeated Spain in the Spanish-American War and made itself a colonial power by taking over the Philippines as well as Puerto Rico. That semi-colonial status to which the Philippines was subjected by the U.S. under William McKinley was confirmed by the Treaty of Portsmouth negotiated by his successor, Theodore Roosevelt, in 1905, the treaty ending the Russo-Japanese War. But what's little known is the secret codicil to the Treaty of Portsmouth, which was the Taft-Kaitsura Agreement, in which the U.S. gave Japan Korea in exchange for the U.S. having a free hand in the Philippines and confirming its status as a semi-colonial power in the Philippines. And so there's a very long history of U.S. involvement in Asia, which connects directly with the treatment of Asian Americans in this country. Obviously, one of the things that we know from very recent history is that rhetoric coming from the White House can have a profound effect on the lives of Asians, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders here in this country. Donald Trump, as insider-in-chief, incited violence against APIs by referring to the coronavirus with racialized rhetoric, calling it the China virus and the Wuhan virus and the Kung flu. But unfortunately, Joe Biden, while his rhetoric has certainly been marginally better, has engaged in anti-China rhetoric, which is also profoundly problematic, which is belligerent, and which connects to anti-China rhetoric from the Cold War, casting China as a threatening enemy, allied with North Korea as another threatening enemy. And of course, U.S. involvement in Asia involved contestation of the Korean Peninsula in the Korean War from 1950 to 1953, ended by an armistice. Technically, the Korean War has never fully been concluded. And so I certainly support the work of Korea Peace Now in calling for a formal end to the Korean War and the peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula. U.S. involvement continued with the Vietnam War escalation under LBJ and then under Richard Nixon, finally coming to an end under Gerald Ford, 1975. But that long history of involvement has made worse the problem of Asian Americans cast as eternal foreigners in the United States because of U.S. wars on the Asian continent going back to the Korean War and the World War II, the Korean War, and then the Vietnam War.
And what happens to the people who are here and their specific treatment as a result of using a kind of white nationalist, colonialist, imperialist design to demonize these countries, and how that inures to the treatment of people here of Asian descent, and how, of course, the whole issue then of how they are viewed, how xenophobia is used to gin up the interests of U.S. foreign policy affects what happens in terms of the hatred, the racism, the discrimination, the disparate treatment that occurs to people of Asian ancestry here.
What we've witnessed here in New York in the last few months has been a spate of anti-Asian hate crimes, most recent which took place in Manhattan, in which a 65-year-old woman was assaulted by a man who shouted at her, "Go back to where you came from. You don't belong here." That rhetoric of xenophobia relates directly to this long and sordid history of U.S. involvement in Asia, of demonizing various Asian countries as the enemy, Imperial Japan during World War II, then Communist China and North Korea in the 1950s, Communist North Vietnam in the 1960s and the 1970s. So there's that connection. It's important to point out that the hate crimes committed against the Asian women in Atlanta on March 16th were not only racialized violence, but they were also gendered violence. That relates to the construction of Asian women by white dominant American society. Asian women are sexualized, exoticized, and fetishized by the white male gaze, G-A-Z-E, and many of them, including recent Asian immigrants and most of the women who were murdered in the Atlanta area on March 16th, were recent immigrants. They are employed by massage parlors operating on the margins of the sex industry. Regardless of whether they were actually engaged in performing sex acts, they were employed in an occupation which cast them in a role servicing the sexual needs and fantasies mainly of white men. So we have to understand the gendered element as well as the sexualized element. And that is why I argue that an intersectional analysis is actually not only the best way, it's the only way that we'll understand the full totality of the hate crimes that were committed on March 16th. It's important also to mention that the attempt by the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office to excuse these murders on the part of a murderer who, quote-unquote, was just having a bad day, also with regard to the allegation that he was the victim of a sex addiction, relates to the long history of Puritanism, goes back to colonial New England. Important to recognize that Christian fundamentalists in this country encourage men to think of sex outside of marriage as inherently evil, and that any other kind of sex or sexual desire can lead to sexual addiction. So that's another element in the gendered, sexualized, racialized violence that we saw so vividly and violently on display in Georgia on March 16th.
Of course, on one hand, they have used whatever psychosis this individual had to try to, again, damp down or vitiate or dismiss entirely the issue of the hatred specific to not any women, but to Asian women. They seem to uncouple the reality that these were women and these were Asian women, and then remove it from the fact, which is, to me, part of the xenophobia and racism, that recent immigrants are traditionally relegated to the lowest rung of the economy, to some of the most difficult forms of work, and very often for women, sex work in order to. And I wonder about your thoughts on that, too, as part of the racism that inures to immigrant women and immigrant women of Asian ancestry.
Immigrants to begin with to this country face many difficulties, especially those who are undocumented. I don't know whether the women who were murdered on March 6th were undocumented or not, but even if they had the legal right to work in this country, if they had limited English language proficiency, that would also limit their employment opportunities. And not only in a neoliberal capitalist economy, but one burdened with the current coronavirus pandemic, opportunities for employment for Asian migrants and migrant women would be severely constricted. Given that, given the white male gaze and the sexualization, exoticization, fetishization of the Asian female body by white men, very often they are channeled into different forms of work, including sex work. In some cases, they're actively trafficked into sex work and other forms of marginal exploitative labor.
I'm speaking with Pauline Park, and we are examining the centuries-long history of anti-Asian racism and violence in the U.S. Pauline, the Atlanta massacre and the wave of anti-Asian hate crime have produced calls for increased policing, but seem to negate the implications of it being a hate crime, which would engender a socio-political response from the broader community relevant to the privilege that accompanies white supremacy and the rectification educationally and in other ways that were promoters of this violence that was perpetrated against these women. And I wonder about it, your thoughts on that issue, stemming from my concern that these must be understood as hate crimes, but why it is so critical to look at this in a historic context.
It is important to understand the murders of these six Asian women in a larger context and not misunderstand them as simply isolated incidents by a young man with mental health issues. There is this long history going back to the 1850s of violence against Asian immigrants. While the calls for increased policing are understandable, such calls are problematic because the police are not necessarily our friends. The NYPD has engaged in routine brutality against communities of color. The NYPD really can't be trusted, and that's probably true of police departments in most cities across this country. Now, as far as hate crimes legislation goes, there's an important distinction here to be made. There is called enhanced penalties hate crimes legislation. New York State enacted a hate crimes law that has an enhanced penalties provision depending on the severity of the violence involved. However, it has not prevented hate crimes from being committed in this state. The same may be said of Matthew Shepard, James Byrd Hate Crimes Prevention Act, enacted by Congress in 2009. The important distinction here is between enhanced penalties, hate crimes statutes, and laws that require identification of hate crimes and collection of data. The former only adds to the power of the prison industrial complex. The latter documents, monitor hate crimes against members of marginalized groups.
The incident of the U.S. Marine Joseph Pemberton, the murder that he perpetrated. And I want you to tell us about that and whether or not, indeed, that the whole treatment and understanding of that further enculturates an acceptance by demonizing the person who was killed, creates an acceptance or a passivity to the reality of hate crimes that have been perpetrated against people of Asian ancestry.
In 2014, a 26-year-old transgendered Filipina named Jennifer Laude was murdered by a member of the U.S. Marine Corps, Joseph Pemberton. He was ultimately convicted, which was the first conviction ever of a member of the U.S. military on Asian soil. However, that conviction was somewhat vitiated by his subsequent release. The tragic case of this murder of this transgendered Filipina woman points up the intersection of all these various forms of oppression, both in terms of gender and gender identity, and race and ethnicity and nationality, and U.S. involvement in the Philippines, a country in which the U.S. continues to exercise a quasi-neocolonial power. So this is a really important case in understanding how violence is perpetrated, often by heteronormative white men, against Asian women, including Asian trans women. Another example is an example of racialized and sexualized violence against an Asian woman was the murder on the 25th of November 2017 of Yang Song, an Asian sex worker in Flushing who was trying to escape the NYPD. It is believed threw her from the balcony of a high-rise building in Flushing. That prompted the formation of the Red Canary Song Coalition, which has also formed a larger coalition to advance legislation in the state legislature to decriminalize sex work under New York state law. This is really vital not only for Asian immigrants, because so many Asian immigrant women participate in the sex industry in some form or other, in many cases on a non-voluntary basis because they're trafficked into it. It's also vitally important for the transgender community because transgendered women are often assumed by the police to be sex workers simply because they're transgendered, regardless of whether they're actually involved with sex work. That bill was introduced by Assemblymember Ahn Kim into the Assembly and is currently pending. I support that legislation, and I represent my organization, Niagara, the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy, in that coalition. That legislation is vitally important. One other type of legislation that is an example of the way forward, and that's the New York State Dignity for All Students Act, which was enacted by the state legislature in 2012, prohibits discrimination and bias-based harassment in public schools throughout the state based on a comprehensive list of characteristics, including race, religion, ethnicity, disability, sexual orientation, and gender, defined to include gender identity. It was the first transgender inclusive legislation ever introduced into the New York State Legislature. I helped write the provision, the definition of gender that was included in that important law. It was advanced by a multiracial, multi-issue coalition that included API organizations, LGBT organizations, women's organizations, Muslim and Jewish organizations, human rights, civil rights organizations, across a broad span of progressive activism. And it's a really good model for how we can operate. It doesn't involve any policing. It doesn't in any way enhance the prison industrial complex. What it does is provide opportunities for school districts across the state of New York to engage training. I have done transgender sensitivity training now for 20 years to educate schools and school districts, faculty, staff, and students on discrimination and bias-based harassment. So in terms of legislation, both the Dignity for All Students Act, the Dignity in Schools Act, which is the companion piece legislation enacted by the New York City Council, as well as the legislation that would decriminalize sex work under New York state law, are examples of progressive legislation that can bring together broad coalitions of organizations and communities that can help educate and transform society. Because what we need to do, ultimately has transformed the way society understands sex, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, race, ethnicity, and nationality. That can't be done solely or primarily through policing or incarceration, which in the long run, I think, only set us back.
Pulling apart the notion that what certain members of the white Eurocentric liberal community feel is something that is helpful, but this conceptualization that there is something specific to the many populations that form the Asian diaspora, that there is a model minority conceptualization. How is that any different, or isn't that exactly a part of the reactionary and supremacist thinking about a group of people? What's wrong with that notion?
The model minority myth has been propagated now for nearly a half century. It first appeared in print decades ago and was advanced really by mainstream media. The notion is that Asian Americans, through hard work, can achieve the American dream. As tantalizing as that notion is, the model minority myth is in fact a myth, because keeping your head down, working hard, and trying to assimilate into a white dominant culture does not protect you from discrimination, abuse, harassment, or violence, as we've seen in the last year, as we saw in Atlanta on March 16th. The model minority myth is pernicious because it denies the roots of structural oppression that continue to impede APIs, especially recent immigrants and Asian women in particular. And it also pits APIs against other communities of color, holding out the prospect of a kind of a honorary white status for Asian Americans, and implicitly trying to pit them against African Americans and Latinos and Latinas. The model minority myth has not helped us as Asian Americans, and in fact has impeded the formation of coalitions of solidarity with African Americans and Latinx people. So I think it's really important that we finally scrap the model minority myth, embrace our status as people of color, form coalitions of solidarity with other communities of color to challenge white discourse on race, including overarching structures of white supremacy in U.S. society.
What would you suggest is an imperative step to take in response to the hate crime that was perpetrated against the murder of these six Asian Pacific Islander women, and broader legislative, cultural, educative steps that must be taken to deal with the reality of white supremacy, which is at the root, the reality of white nationalism, which is at the root, the Eurocentrism that we are enculturated with as a preferential way of analyzing and looking at the world. What do we begin to do to deal with this cancer of bias, racism, xenophobia, and discrimination, which has been fine-tooled by political opportunists now, and it's rampant in this society?
there are several things we can do. First, we need sustained public attention, including in the mainstream media, to issues of racial discrimination and violence, including violence against APIs. If there's any silver lining coming out of the dark cloud of these horrible murders in Atlanta, maybe that's one. Number two, to challenge those who want to increase policing and use incarceration from prosecution under hate crimes laws with enhanced penalties provision as the solution to the problem. Three, we need to suggest community-based solutions. A volunteer corps has formed in Chinatown to patrol the streets of Chinatown in Manhattan. These are Asian Americans who are walking the streets of Chinatown to try to intervene in any cases of harassment or violence directed against residents there. That funding that could be taken, frankly, from the enormous budget of the NYPD, which is nearly $6 billion a year, larger than the budgets of most foreign militaries, could be used to help fund patrols of community members in the most affected areas. Three, we need to advance legislation such as the decriminalization of sex work under state law and legislation such as DASA, the Dignity for All Students Act, which addresses discrimination and bias-based harassment in public schools. We need to fully implement those laws that are already on the books, and those laws need to be implemented through extensive training in schools and in other institutions in society. We need to identify the best individuals from affected communities to do such training and public education. We need to fund that kind of public education seriously, and that could so easily be funded by not only defunding the police, but defunding aspects of military expenditure that are not only not necessary, but aren't even sought by the military itself. We spend billions on military equipment that is not only not necessary, not even wanted by military, but that enrich defense contractors. There is the money to do this. The question is there the political will? All these measures are examples of what we need to do. I think this program, my interview with you, is an example of how to engage that conversation. It has to be a sustained national conversation that has to incorporate real understanding of the long history of anti-Asian discrimination and violence in this country. It has to be informed by that, but has to be informed by a progressive feminist intersectional analysis that doesn't take each of these parts and separate them from each other, but brings them together into a full understanding of what brought us where a young man would take an assault rifle and shoot dead 8 people, including 6 Asian immigrant women, in massage parlors in Atlanta.
Well, we have to leave it there. Your contribution to my understanding is enormously important and helpful, and seeds the soil for us to plow forward and root up and pull out root and branch every practice and policy of racism, discrimination, xenophobia that exists against people of Asian ancestry. Pauline Park, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Everyone is fighting for equality. Justice. Palestinians fighting for equal rights. Justice down in Angola. Equal rights. Justice down in Botswana.
Now we're joined by Chuck Collins, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who'll provide a shocking expose of the insider's machinery of inequality, the elaborate scheme to hide more than $20 trillion in wealth, who offers us a blueprint for reversing this obscene inequality.
I see how concentrations of wealth will, if we just play this out another decade or two, lead to the end of democracy as we know it. The whole idea of a self-governing democracy hangs on the idea that we don't have monarchy, hereditary wealth dynasties that control and write the rules and dominate our politics, some room to move for the rest of us. I see that under siege. The other reason I wrote this book is we understand inequality. We understand how the wealthy have captured a lion's share of the productivity gains over the last couple decades. This is one of the less understood mechanisms. It's one thing to sort of see wealth grow. It's sort of the other thing is how do you sequester it, hide it, protect it for not just the next generation or the next, but for centuries to come. And in the last 15, 20 years, a whole industry has grown up for that purpose. And that's what I wanted to talk to people about. In some ways, it's nothing new. But what I would say is in our lifetime, say the last 40 years, the concentration of wealth has grown, and so has the number of people who wake up every morning and whose paying job is to help the super rich hide their money. And when I mean the super rich, I'm talking about the one-tenth of 1%, so that today that would be people with $20, $25 million or more. So they have money that they can afford to hire professionals, tax attorneys, accountants, wealth managers. And if they're really wealthy, you know, $250 million or more, they actually kind of create a family office and bring all those services in-house to manage their wealth. Central to their whole purpose is continued accumulation, tax avoidance, and passing it on to the next generation and the next generation. So it inherently is a dynastic, dynasty-building enterprise. What's new is the scale. You know, the Rockefellers had a family office 100 years ago, and plantation economies had their servants and butlers and others who protected wealth, and in the feudal times, people hired private mercenary armies to defend their wealth. But in the last century, this is sort of the form it's taking. We're talking somewhere between $24 and $36 trillion of wealth that has basically vanished from the ledger, has moved to the shadows, and that's a lot of money. If you think of the last 150 years or so, there was a period before World War I when there were the first Gilded Age fortunes that came from extracting wealth and steel and oil and the various big trusts and companies. And then there was this interesting period where we started to tax wealth. We had a progressive inheritance tax and progressive taxation and a depression and World War II. And there were fewer dynastic families that sort of emerged from that period. But let's just take one that, you know, most people are familiar with, Sam Walton, founding Walmart in 1983, under $6 billion in today's money. Now his descendants and grandchildren have about $250 billion. Or take the Mars family, the Mars candy bar empire, you know, had about $1 billion in 1983, now has almost $100 billion in wealth. And what I would say is in the 1930s up until the 80s, with a functioning progressive tax system, wealth over generations sort of dispersed. People have children, they pay their taxes, sometimes they even share their money and give it to charity. And three generations later, you're not a billionaire. You're not a powerful oligarch. And there's a lot of examples of families that would fit that story. And I think what's happened with these families is they figured out how to arrest that process, avoid paying taxes, and see their wealth accelerate over generations. And that's what I'm focusing attention on here.
Although Walton's different than perhaps suggests Bezos, and since I am filled with concern as to the growth of the wealth and the numbers of people employed by particularly non-union workers at Amazon who are fighting for their lives to unionize as we speak. Give us some practical sense of how these people really hoard their wealth and the mechanisms that are put in place to further this.
The example I gave were what I would consider kind of multi-generation now, third, fourth generation into it. Whereas Bezos is still, you could say, in the first generation. Amazon is a relatively recent phenomena. But the thing to be concerned about here is, first of all, obviously Bezos has built a wealth extraction machinery by underpaying workers and by being in the right place at the right time during a pandemic where a lot of his competition has been shut down. This company is extracting huge amounts of value and benefiting from Main Street suffering. Even during the pandemic, you know, here's a guy whose wealth has gone up 76% in just a year to, you know, $160, $170 billion. What we should be monitoring is how much taxes is he paying, how much money is moving into trust, offshore tax havens, partnerships and tax loopholes that avoid taxation. I'm sure he has a whole armada of wealth defense industry workers helping him reduce his tax and hide as much money in trusts. So those are the tools that the super rich use. And what we should be concerned about is not just the current way he's making his money, but what will his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, will they still be dynastic powerhouses? Will we be reading about them on the society pages? And his charitable foundations are part of that. More and more of the super wealthy have these private foundations that the rest of us have subsidized, and they are extensions of their private power and influence, the Koch brothers being a great example of that. So we should be concerned about the multi-generational impact of a Bezos wealth dynasty.
So let's continue to lay out a blueprint, if you will, for these entrenching hereditary dynasties of wealth and power and the mechanisms that are set in place to facilitate that. How do these function to replicate, increase, and continue the wealth of what are now dynasties that you examine?
Say you have $1 billion, Mimi, and you've come to me as your wealth planner. First thing I'm going to do is say, well, look, let's put a large chunk of this into a trust. You create the trust, and I'm your trustee, and you might be the beneficiary, or your children or grandchildren or some other family member will be the beneficiary. What we've just done is create an ownership limbo. We have kind of pretended that no one holds that money for tax purposes, and you're going to just park a ton of money over there. And then we're going to put some of that other money offshore. We're going to get you a nice bank account in the U.S. Virgin Islands or the British Virgin Islands or the Cayman Islands. And you'll have some shell companies there where the assets will be held by an anonymous shell company. Maybe it's incorporated in Delaware. And we'll probably use some form of all of those tools. That's what wealthy people have, and that's how they – complexity and secrecy is the bread and butter for this wealth defense industry. These billionaires – pay millions to these wealth defenders to hide trillions.
What kind of monies are we talking about? And of course, then what are the implications for that for a society? What are the ramifications of this kind of hidden money?
I think the estimates now are somewhere between $24 and $36 trillion. You know, roughly 12% of the world's wealth is hidden globally. When they take this money and hide it, and they avoid taxes, well, obviously it shifts the tax obligations onto everyone else. If they're not paying their fair share, the rest of us are picking up the slack. Another reason we should be concerned from a global justice point of view is the rich elites of countries around the world are extracting and stealing money from their own people, but then they have to move it. They usually move it out of their country, whether you're a Russian oligarch or a dictator from a resource-rich country in the global south. At some point, you move that money out of your country, and you probably bring it to the United States. because we have these property rights protections and we have anonymous shell companies right here in Delaware. You can form a Delaware limited liability company and hide your money. So, again, from a global justice point of view, these countries are being looted and the money is being hidden. This hidden wealth system is the mechanism by which the natural resource wealth and the wealth of many nations is siphoned away. For example, Angola. Up until 3 years ago, the president of Angola, his daughter, Isabel dos Santos, the wealthiest woman in Africa, very close to the government, had all the business ventures. He was helped by the Boston Consulting Group and McKinsey and these consulting firms and others to set up all these accounts. And she basically moved about $2 billion out of Angola. You're basically taking food out of the mouths of babes and funneling it into the bank accounts of the super rich. And that, unfortunately, is played out all across the world. Wealthy elites in Latin America plunder their own national wealth through both kleptocracy, corruption, the movement of illicit money. And a lot of that is natural resource, where global companies will underpay for oil and minerals and the like, and will take those profits and move them out of those countries. So it's almost impossible for these countries to develop when so much wealth is being extracted. You know, estimates are for every dollar of aid that goes to Africa, $3 is flowing out in the form of illicit funds and this kind of plundering.
What is to be done? Because the whole nature still of capitalism is to further this. Certainly, we all know that easy slogan of, well, they bail, you know, they exist. It's corporate welfare, in effect. It's there to bail out Wall Street and be damned Main Street. So short of dismantling the system which aids and abets this, what are we to do? Is there really any mechanism for beginning to carve away at this incredible hoarding and replication and enhancement of wealth?
This can be fixed within the context of, say, the last century. Some of the proposals on the table, like Senator Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax, would actually start to slow and reverse this concentration of wealth. Last week, Senator Sanders introduced his revised estate tax bill. What people don't realize is in that legislation, these trusts that I'm talking about are outlawed. They would be shut down. And it sort of shows what's possible. Are obviously social movements pressuring, like this rather unusual COVID relief bill that passed, this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, it begins to provide, you know, almost a guaranteed income for lower income households. It expands access to health insurance. It fixes pension programs. It brings rural broadband. It's starting to make big social investments that will improve the quality of life for a lot of people. Just thinking about the next year and the next steps, we can actually start to close down this hidden wealth apparatus. And there's obviously it's an international system, but if the United States gets our house in order, Europe is already moving quicker than the United States to fix this. If we join with the UK and essentially think of the old colonial empires and those countries become the drivers of transparency and change, we can start to really reverse this, reduce the concentration of wealth, move toward a more Danish or Nordic social democracy model where there isn't the same extreme inequality. There's still going to be elements of capitalist society that we have to work to address, but it would really make a huge difference for millions and maybe billions of people. We've been watching these issues for a while. It used to be when you talked about taxing the wealthy, it never polled well. People were like, well, someday I'll become wealthy and I don't want to tax the rich. Support for taxing the rich is at an all-time high because people know that the wealthy are rigging the rules of the game. So there's anger and pressure building for that. So I guess I take heart in that these cracks are emerging and we're in a political moment where serious reforms may actually win. A wealth tax to pay for an infrastructure bill, greater enforcement of the tax rules as they apply to the rich, to pay for things that people need and that will make a big difference in people's life. This is not a monolithic system, and the seeds of its own demise are built into it. It's not sustainable from a social or ecological point of view. So all those things, I think, you know, it can still go badly. It could still go more authoritarian. But I also see some light shining through those cracks.
I want you to give us just a couple of final highlights for reversing, as Bernie Sanders has called it, the obscene inequality that exists, so we can take back or really build or realize the promise of democracy.
People don't want to see these inequalities grow, these dynasties grow, so we should push for cracking down on the rich, abolishing these trusts and hidden wealth systems, just saying they're against the law, they shouldn't be allowed, cross-organizing across borders to shut down the hidden wealth systems around the world. Those are all things that are completely within our reach. So I think, you know, that, and even it's funny, at the end of 2020, Congress passed something called the Corporate Transparency Act, requiring U.S. companies to disclose who their beneficial owners are. Now, there were a couple of loopholes in there for trusts, but that's a significant change. Part of that came because people who work in law enforcement are seeing all the criminal activity that the system allows. You know, if you're trying to track down a drug dealer and all of a sudden you hit a brick wall, which is that their business is owned by a Delaware limited liability company, you're like, I want to know who owns that company. I want to know who's behind it. And I want to get access to that money. There's a movement that's building that understands the system and is taking it on.
Well, Chuck Collins, thank you for your morality, your sense of egalitarianism, and the enormously important work that you've done this many years on inequality and poverty in our society, and the inequality of the distribution of wealth. And again, dear listeners, the wealth hoarders, how billionaires pay millions to hide trillions. You need to understand this so that we can make sure that we are not tilting at windmills, but are really beginning to do what we need to dismantle the vulgar hoarding of wealth that has everything to do with the maintenance of poverty and inequality and all that flows from the failure of an equitable system of wealth distribution in a society. Chuck Collins, thanks so much for joining us. And do, listeners, pick up The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. I'm Amy Rosenberg for Equal Rights and Justice, saying, educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
I do my hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling?
And if you're headed out like Lizzo, you grab your cell phone, your keys, and your mask. And if you don't have a WBAI mask yet, call 516-620-3000. 3602 and order one in white or black, 516-620-3602 for a contribution of $35 to this listener-sponsored non-corporate radio station. These masks are cool. They're in black or white. They're 100% cotton. They have the saying, "Keep Free Speech Radio Alive" on them. And remember, when you head out the door, you grab your keys, you grab your cell phone, you check yourself, and you grab your mask, and you put it on.
This is WBAI, and this is Fred Eagle Smith for WBAI in New York. Stick it in your ear.
.5 FM.